I want you to think of questions that you'd like to ask of these folks. Now, we brought Yvonne Lewis here knowing that she would have to leave at 3 o'clock to go do the broadcast at 5. So she's going to have to leave.
We've been trying to teach just a little bit about what civil discourse is. And I've been offering a definition that after several Sunday school classes of having done this, same definition, and after the first two sessions, I decided I'm altering the definition a little bit because my mind has changed. There's something I was missing. The first part, all good. Civil discourse is a practice of conversation and argument characterized by honesty and mutual respect among people with relatively equal power regarding matters about which participants deeply disagree. And here's where the change comes. And seeking understanding, shared good, or a compromise. Before we get started with your questions, I want to talk some about that word compromise. The truth claims we make in a democracy are different from the ones we make in our faith communities. For in a democracy, and as you were hearing this morning, in the last hour anyways, I don't know if you heard this in church or not, for those who are in church this morning. Truth, or what passes for truth, is deliberated, comes as a result of conversation and argument, not revelation and doctrine. Conflict in democracy should be expected. We're not going to all come out in the same place. Again, this is why compromise also needs to be expected. Also, as a person of faith, I would say that purity codes in civil society are dangerous to the social fabric because they are used to divide people into clean and unclean. Purity codes, that's a sociological term about drawing fairly rigid or impermeable social boundaries between people of this sort and people of that sort. And oftentimes religion one of the ways we name what is clean and what is unclean. All right, which has its role in each of our religious traditions. Once you carry it out of our religious traditions and put it into the social fabric, you've got something different. Hence, again, the need for compromise. And then there's an insight I got a number of years ago, in fact, is when I was working on my doctoral dissertation. I ran into this guy by the name of William Adams Brown, who was a very prominent Protestant theologian at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. And a lot of the people who became the pillars in the modern ecumenical movement were his students, taught at Union Seminary in New York. He did a lot of reflection upon the intersections between Christianity and democracy. And he even talked about what a theological basis for democracy might be. Now, if you're an American, if you believe in our form of governance, it's really difficult to stick your head in anything other than democracy is pretty close to godliness. Right? I mean, you can't imagine another, despite the, what was it, Churchill's phrase, something about democracy is the worst form of government except for every other one we've tried? Right? Can you imagine trying to be in anything else other than a democracy, an aristocracy, an oligarchy, a plutocracy, whatever it is? No. We kind of have this democracy we've raised up to an almost sacred level, which is why we can get misty-eyed along with the best of American orators when we consider about what democracy done well might be. Well, William Adams Brown, as he was talking about a theology for democracy, said, democracy may mean that what God has said to me is different from what God has said to you. Rather than God speaks with one voice in all things at all times, and in fact, get a better sense of what God might think about some issue, it might take talking to others and listening. Which goes, for me, to the heart of civil discourse. And why am I doing all this? Because a huge part of what civil discourse is, to use something that Stephen Covey talks about, just trying to widen that gap just a little bit between reaction and response. So this is a layer of deliberation that if you're reacting to something that someone has said, you might not get to. This is practicing one of the disciplines that I think is involved in carrying on civil discourse with one another. Can you talk some about the journey of reporting after 9/11 as it relates to Christians, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, etc.?
Well, the journey of reporting, I mean, it obviously changed some. We were talking about this at the break, sort of. Before 9/11 and back in my early career in the Tulsa World, the city and the state and the country, for that matter, was pretty much Christian or Jewish. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot said. 9/11 did it. It changed things, and it changed some things for the worse in some areas, I think. But the journey of reporting, even after that horrific incident, I don't think it changed that much. I mean, what has changed news is people who can say anything they want to on the internet. I think for the most part, the Tulsa World and most other news organizations around here, particularly, all of a sudden people woke up and said, my goodness, there are Muslim people living in our country. And they've been here for quite a while. And then they started, and we got this a lot back in the opinion section when I would write on this, the Muslim just want to kill all the Christians. And that's so untrue. I mean, anybody with a rational mind knows that. I don't know that the journey changed that much, because our goal, the legitimate media, our goal is still to present just facts and truth, which I spoke about earlier. And the truth is, and the facts are, that yeah, there's a segment of this country, in this state, in this city, that are Muslim, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they're all just like us. I mean, they're just regular people. This happened to have a different religion. I mean, I argue with people not all the time, but too often about, you can't really call the Christian religion or Judaism particularly nonviolent if you read, the Bible. So I guess my point, it's a matter of interpretation. I mean, you can look in the Quran or the Bible, and you can find anything you want in there that can... you can justify some sort of terrorist act. So the people who attacked us weren't Muslims. They happened to be Muslims, but it had nothing to do with the religion. It had to do with the fact they were just crazy people who wanted to hurt us. And you can find that in any segment of society, unfortunately. And so I don't think our journey changed all that much. I think it just the focus may have changed, or maybe we tried better to make people understand that. I don't know that we achieved it so much, because there's still a lot of hatred and mistrust and out there, which we don't like. But the journey is we keep trying. We're not going to quit. We're not going to give up, and we're not going to just say, "Oh yeah, you're right." That's not going to happen. I know Muslim people, and they're good people. So,
I think the problem is the adjective in front of extremism,
yeah.
And nobody likes it when it's your faith. And let's face it, we have Christian extremists, we have Muslim extremists, we have Hindu extremists, we have Jewish extremists. Every faith has extremists. And I think the one thing I try to do in my own reporting and interviewing is to separate the act of individuals from the faith as much as I can. And to point that out, sometimes it interrupts the flow. I mean, we also have other things going as a part of the conversation. But when I hear blanket statements of religion, I always feel usually compelled to break in. I mean, extremism is in every faith tradition and in a lot of intellectual pursuits as well. And that's what we have to worry about. When we talk about acts of Christian extremism, Boy, that gets immediate reaction. Yet we have them, you know. There are acts out there, and I think it's always important to think these are individuals, not faiths, doing these acts.
Now, add one more thing to that, and it comes from Alexander de Tocqueville, who wrote a book a long time ago called Democracy in America. He was French. He came over here. He went around America and wrote a great book about it called Democracy in America. And in that book, he said, America is great because America is good. When America ceases to be good, it will cease to be great. And that's the thing. I mean, if we're not good to each other, eventually that's gonna eat away at society and our culture. And when we give up tolerance and understanding, I don't know what the answer to that is. So,
actually, that's a wonderful quote. But my understanding is that like a dozen really famous people have all attributed that to de Tocqueville, and it's not actually in Democracy in America.
It isn't. Well, I read it and thought it was as good as it is.
Okay, so I want to
read the book. I thought it was in there.
I think you read that on the internet.
Did I just make that up? If I just made that up, it's a,
you know, even Colin Powell has done that same thing. So you're in good company, definitely. but I want to follow up because there are a number of questions around this cluster of issues here.
Okay.
One would be a widespread perception that I'll bet you, if you actually did a word search on it, you'd find that while there are extremists in all faiths, and I think most people, certainly the group that was planning this, assume there's extremism, however you want to define it, in all faiths, Islamic and extremists have been paired since 9/11 in a way that has been injurious to Islam. And has in fact caused a level of fear and lack of safety and security for Muslims. And that may not be so much here, and this because the other part of what I'm seeing in these questions is any perceptual difference between local discourse on such matters and national discourse. Because certainly in national discourse, the pairing of Islamic with extremist is almost become knee-jerk. At least that's my perception and the number of people who are working on this trialogue thought. So I'm curious about get your responses to that.
In the days after 9/11, I think we were all looking for the right term. I know for a while it was Muslim fundamentalist, and then we realized that was pretty, that was tarring with a broad brush. I think Islamic extremist is an accurate term for those that commit those acts, but I also think it's still not nuanced enough, because a lot of acts attributed to Islamic extremism go to tribal and ethnic disputes. It goes to a whole lot of things, and it's not necessarily Islamic extremism targeting other faiths. They're targeting divisions within their own, or ethnic or sect conflicts. And I think Yvonne had a really good comment about time. The average news story on a network newscast, time it sometime. It's a minute and a half, 2 minutes tops. You can't get a lot of specifics, and you can't get into subtleties in 2 minutes. And even on public radio, where you have 4 and 5 minute stories, 4 and 5 minute stories don't also have limitations of complexity and subtleties that really need to be explained for people to really have a full understanding. I remember a day when we did 9 minute stories. Well, we don't really do 9 minute stories anymore. We don't do 15 minute stories. A lot of times it's 4 and 5 minutes. It's about as much as we have. There's only so much nuance and complexity that you can put in there. And sometimes you're looking for the words that most accurately convey that in the least amount of time. And I think that's where people might hear that phrase a little more. But, you know, it's again a problem of, I mean even in the newspaper you got column inches, you only have so many. And you gotta edit it to fit this the space. I mean, the worst thing you want to read in a newspaper is a story that basically said you got 15 column inches and it just stops. I've seen some papers where that's happened occasionally, and that's very unsatisfying. So, I mean, there has to be things eliminated for length considerations, and a lot of times it's the complexity and the nuance of what we're reporting on and what we're the story we're trying to tell. You know, as best as we can.
There's also it's something I don't like, but it's a fact. But there's a sort of a pack mentality in journalism, and it something easy comes up like that, like say Muslim terrorists or Muslim extremists. It's easy, and sometimes sometimes we get lazy, and all of a sudden that word, that phrase starts being used, and next thing you know, everyone's using it. I was sitting here thinking when Rich was talking. I was trying to remember when we really started using that. In 1972 at the Olympics, they were Palestinian terrorists. Now, I'm just going to take a wild guess here and say they might have been Muslim. I don't know. But we didn't call, did that start after 9/11? I don't recall that being used. Of course, I mean, because terrorism has been going on for a long time by every religion I can think of, but it seemed like Muslim terrorists, all of a sudden, when they found out the guys who did 9/11 were Muslim, that's the word the media picked up on. That's the first time I remember it. And I mean, there's somebody in this room who can correct me on that. I mean,
Anybody have any knowledge? I mean, I know how it was tied so closely to 9/11, but yeah. I can't go back further than
and,
that.
And once myself. That happened, then it became too easy. And because it fits in a headline, or it fits, boom, in a promo for a news story.
I would say that's the politicians that were saying that, not necessarily the media. Yeah, in fact, some right here in our hometown.
Right. Well, they had those unconfirmed reports, you know, and I hate those.
Tom?
Well, it has been used. I mean, Rudolph, remember him? He blew up the abortion clinics and... Eric Rudolph.
Yeah.
He was sort of a Christian terrorist, but I don't remember it being thrown around a lot. The folks up in Kansas, at the church in Kansas, I guess you could maybe call them Christian terrorists, although I don't think they've done anything violent. But you're right. I don't hear Christian terrorists used much, or Hindu terrorists.
No, well, I'd say Hindu extremism is used quite often, except we just really don't have it's.
Right.
It's mainly here. In South Asia.
Yeah, it's going on right now.
And it happens a lot. But I think that is a good point, is that that term isn't used.
Right.
And that when an act of Christian extremism takes place, it's very quick to be labeled an individual. And I think with an issue of Islamic extremism, tends to be not an individual, but a faith.
And it's always easier for the majority to label a minority something.
Thank you. And this I think goes to the heart of this is a perception issue. I don't know how it factually bears out, which is the perception that Islam at its core is violent. That Islam as a religion of peace and compassion, which is what we've heard, and what I think many of us in this room believe, is not in fact the way that Muslims have Muslim or Islam has been portrayed nationally. I referred last week to the episode of The West Wing that was produced immediately after 9/11. It was in the same month. In fact, it was the first opening show of the season, where one of the characters in there, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff, Josh Lyman's character, is with a group of civic students in the basement of the White House while the White House is under lockdown because of somebody in the White House employment whose name showed up on a terrorist watch list. They're getting a civics lesson downstairs. And Josh writes out on a pad of paper, Islamic extremists is to Islam as blank is to Christianity. And the answer he filled in there was KKK. So that We have our crazies, right? Well spoken. However, I think that why the narrative of Islam and violence connected has taken such root and is so difficult to unroot is because of a perception born of ignorance and of what caught people's attention in the media, that Islam and violence are inherently connected.
May I follow up? And one of the things I think the dominant religion gets often defines the terms. If you're in India, it's Muslim extremists committing acts in India. If you're in Pakistan, it's Hindu extremists committing acts in Pakistan or the Muslim minority in India. I can't speak to the Middle East, but I would assume it's the same regarding disputes between Jews and Muslims and Palestinians and Jews in the Middle East. I would assume whoever the dominant religion is gets, by default, defines the terms.
Thank you. I'm going to shift because there's several questions, and we'll give you this. I'm going to read all three of them because they'll give you an idea of some of the diversity of starting viewpoints in the room regarding these terms that, at least in the theological world, we're finding increasingly irrelevant, and that's liberal and conservative, because there's lots of folks starting to mix it up. So let me just read the three of them, and then we'll see what kinds of questions can emerge out of the three. What does the development of non-objective news sources such as Fox or MSNBC mean for the furtherance of civil discourse? Because we heard a lot here about journalistic objectivity, and we also have, named two stations, which are at least alleged to be highly partisan in one way or another. Another question, why is radio talk show circuit so heavily conservative? On another side, do you think that most of the national media personnel are politically liberal? So, liberal and conservative, tell us how that works out in your world.
It takes a lot of different people to make a world. And they all exist in our area, believe it or not. Radio talk shows, certainly on the AM dial, AM listening is dwindling fast. And so that formula it's the one way to make money. I mean, and it really comes down in the commercial media, it's about making money. You can deliver a good audience. I mean, you should not look at radio talk shows as news. First of all, don't do that.
Yeah.
It's entertainment. News attainment. Maybe that's what it is. Its sole reason is not public service. It's to make money. That's why the host is heard on the commercials. And it is, you know, it draws a big minority of the overall radio audience, but it gets about 10%, and 10% can make you the market leader at any given point of the day, and that means you can make some money, and that's why it's there. It's not a representation of the whole political spectrum, but it's there. We have free media airwaves, but I think the thing to take away is radio talk shows are not news programs. Even mine is not a news program. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to keep clear in mind. I do want to address the non-objective news sources. We were talking before. You know, everybody talks about how we have to have an objective journalism in all instances in this country. First of all, with the fairness doctrine being gone for over 20 years, we should not be surprised that that's not the case anymore. And it was never was the case except for a very short, narrow point in our history for about 40 years. American media has always been incredibly opinionated, and all you have to do is go back and read colonial broadsides to see, I mean, duels were fought over things written in the newspaper, and we should never forget that. But it goes back to buyer beware, and it's up to you to separate the wheat from the chaff. I think we have great objectivity in the news section of our newspapers. Of course, the op-ed page is going to have a political point of view or an editorial point of view. I still think most news reporting on most broadcast news stations are pretty objective. I think even with MSNBC, I don't really see a lot of news coming out of that shop, frankly. It's mostly opinion. There is a little bit of news on Fox. I'll take up for Fox a little bit in saying there is a little news, but the whole thing is it's all lumped together with opinion and commentary, so it blurs the line an awful lot. But I think the news producers, for the most part, are trying to be objective. I think what happens is beyond the news producers up higher, there's this blurring of commentary. And it's impossible to know where news begins and ends and commentary ends and begins.
The New York Times is a liberal newspaper. The Wall Street Journal is a conservative newspaper on their opinion sections. Their news sections on both of them are outstanding. Their reporters are outstanding. I don't see much bias in their news reporting. Now there may be a news analysis or something that's a little, if you want to call New York Times a liberal newspaper, yes, it is because they support mostly Democrats. They support liberal causes, but that's what newspapers do. Is what Rich was saying. That's what newspapers do. We've always had opinion sections. Even in our opinions that we write at the Tulsa World, the ones I write, I don't just sit down and get angry and write something, although I guess it sometimes seems that way. But, I really do think things through and try to think things through objectively and try to see the other side and actually talk to people sometimes who have a different opinion of what I'm going to have. So it's not like it's just... You're still. You have objective thoughts because you have to think these things through. I mean, if you're going to take a position on an issue, you better know the other, at least sort of know the other side, because they're going to come back on you. But when everybody says, well, it's NBC's liberal because they're in New York. Well, everybody. I don't think everybody go upstate New York and you won't. There are not a whole lot of liberals up there. I don't. It's an easy tag. When somebody says it's the liberal media, it's a Sarah Palin deal, the lamestream press. It's even hard for me to say, but it's little things. I had my old editorial page editor, the first one I had, Alan Sadwan, great man, wonderful man. He had I'm a little bit off the subject, but not much. He said there's a one-stepper and a two-stepper. And a one-stepper is where a politician gets up and says, your taxes are too high. And everybody says, yeah, they sure are. They're too high. But then the next guy comes along and says, well, but here's why we have these taxes, because, see, you have to have the open the schools and you have to – and well, all of a sudden you got a three-stepper going and they're blank. It's over. Because then the next guy comes back and says, yeah, but your taxes are too high. Well, that's right. My taxes are too high. So it's easy to do in the press and on radio, talk radio especially, where they use that one stepper all the time. They're really good at that, of saying one thing, and then they just hammer and hammer and hammer. The next guy has to come along and try to explain it, and people don't pay that much attention. So I'm getting back to the subject. Opinion columns are written to try to explain the issues, and as does the New York Times and the Tulsa World and the Wall Street Journal, even on the opinion, in the opinion sections, both sides of an issue are always there. We run George Will, who's one of the most popular columnists in the country, but he's conservative. And we run Well, I can't think of the other ones now. I'm sorry. We do run a mix of liberal and conservative columnists, and we do that so that you won't just get one side of an issue. So you can sit down and read Will and say, yeah, he's making a good point, and then you can read E.J. Dionne and say, yeah, but here's the other side, and make up your own mind. You know, if I could convince everybody in this room to think exactly like I do, boy, I'd be a happy guy. But that's not going to happen, and I don't want it to. I'd rather somebody argue with me civilly, and we can walk away at least not friends. At least we understand one another a little better. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to switch up the question some, and I want to have several questions here around the topic we talked about a little bit. What's the responsibility of the faith communities to be able to take responsibility? How do we take responsibility to effectively get our stories out there? And to you all as journalists. So there's some very specific questions here, such as when we call or email or whatever is the right way to contact TV, radio, newspaper, who should we call? Or should it be email? Should it be a phone call? What should it be? I want to step back a second, though, from that very specific kind of question and let you in on what I think is a dilemma we in the religious communities face, which is Americans overall are highly ignorant of other people's religions and are not very informed about their own.
Yeah. Amen.
No, that's statistically true. In fact, Muslims have been amongst the highest knowledge of both their own and other people's religions goes back somewhat to the minority-majority. But not even that. I mean, one of the questions in here said, I'm still trying to get Protestants to understand that Catholics don't worship Mary. And that's been 40 years of trying. Nicholas Kristof in this morning's New York Times put a plea out to academics, which is one of the reasons you see a person like me here, because I hear the plea. Too many academics, too narrow a niche of who it is they're talking to, and not engaged enough in public discourse and shaping discussion. And that is certainly the case when it comes to religion in the United States. Yvonne quoted some statistics that I've seen before also on the knowledge level of journalism of whatever sort in this country when it comes to religion. It's about as low as the population, maybe a little higher because it takes your job. You really have to use it in your job. So given all that ignorance that's out there what you heard us saying earlier about so how do we help get the story of the faith community out there in a way, in a frame, in a narrative form that feels integrous to us, that also might be heard by the public. So that's kind of the dilemma. A lot of ignorance, trying to get the message out. And how do we do that? What are some suggestions you have?
As far as getting the message out, I mean, I pick one with the newspaper, which we're a little bit easier for us because we're a newspaper. I mean, I sort of don't understand the question, because to get your message out, we have a religion editor, we have a letters to the editor column, we have different avenues to get a message. But when you say the message, what's your message? That everybody should be a Baptist? The message is that we're doing something good in the community. If you're doing something good in the community, whether you're a religious group or a United Way group, if you're doing good, it's more than likely going to get out there. Now, does everybody get what they want? No, because every group in this city thinks that what they're doing is the best thing anybody's ever done. And I understand that. I understand that. Our job is to try to figure out which ones we can do. And that's going to upset some people. That's just the way it is. But, you know, your message is there. I mean, you know, as far as the ignorance of religion, yeah, that's... You know, I went to Sunday school when I was a kid and all that, and the First Baptist Church, and grew up and all that. You know, went to college and took some classes in religion. But I don't know everything there is to know about it. I know that younger people today maybe aren't as religious as even I was. And I wasn't exactly a fire and brimstone guy. But I don't know. I mean, to get your message, that's a very strange question, because we used to have a religion editor, Beth Macklin, bless her heart and rest her soul, one wonderful, wonderful person. But anyway, I won't get on about her, but she was agnostic. For a while, we had a religion editor who was agnostic, and we had a medical writer who was a Christian scientist. Now, that seems fair to me. So they didn't have any prejudices one way or the other. And so maybe that's what made them pretty good at that, because they were very open-minded about it. So anyway, I don't know. I'm rambling on that, and I don't know what the answer is. And as far as religious ignorance, that's just a shame. I mean, because you don't understand the works of William Shakespeare if you don't understand religion or the Bible. You don't understand a lot of things if you don't understand the Bible or religion, because our fabric of our culture is based around it, whether we like it or not, whether we believe it or not, it's there. So, I don't know, the churches, you got church on the move and all that stuff is supposed to be attractive to young people, and they go out and do stuff. I don't know what the answer is. There you go.
Rich,
I just rambled around for 5 minutes and didn't give you an answer at all.
Well, I will blow your horn a little bit for the Tulsa World. I mean, I can't think of a whole lot of newspapers that have a religion editor that gets the space that Bill does in the Tulsa World for a lot of communities this size or larger. So, I mean, I think the opportunity is there, and it's about, I don't think there's any secret of what his email address is, and I bet you if you call there, they'll put your call through. So as far as the specifics, I think it's pick up a phone, send an email, drop by.
First.
Yeah. be prepared to be disappointed if you stop by, but call, email, say I'd like to talk to you. I think most reporters and editors are with a proper notice, they'll be happy to talk with you. And at least hear you out. They may decide it's not a story, but that's the other part of it, is that, okay, maybe that's not a story. Maybe the next time you call, it will be a story. I think I notice a lot of people who when I turn somebody down, I say, but please call me again, because while this may not work, the next time it will. And I think a lot of people, once they get the initial rejection, they say, well, they're not going to ever listen to me. Well, we've just got like 9,000 people asking for our attention at any given moment, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there are a lot of competing ideas for attention, and really it's to our advantage and to you as consumers of our product that we really sort of pay attention to that one focus while we're working on it. So I think it's important that you be persistent, be respectful, and you'll probably get respect back, and it will help. I think what the aim of what you're wanting to get out there is important. I think I've done a number of shows on declining church attendance or religious attendance in all traditions. If it's about getting more people in the door, that's not going to be the best approach for coverage unless you've got the best idea since sliced bread, or a new idea. I think we're always attracted to new, interesting approaches. And I think that always works as well. The other thing I'd say is if you are going to get your message out there, be prepared for blowback, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because as I would, from the very open, I think my first statement was, we have an incredibly wide faith tradition. If you go putting your faith tradition out there, you expect people to say, they don't know the answer to that one. We got the answer over here. So I think that's one of the things you should be prepared for.
And the message can be confused sometimes, because I know as my time as city editor, I made an awful lot of people very angry when they would call and they'd want something about their church put in the newspaper. And we, even back then, as big as the newspapers were back then, we still had limited space, and you just can't do it all. And I remember I made several people very angry when I said, I have to explain to you, we're not a church bulletin. So yeah. sometimes the message you're trying to get out is not particularly a message. It's just we're having a potluck supper Sunday night, you know, and everybody come. And I used to make a lot of people very angry. I said, you know, you needed to put that in the church bulletin, not in the Tulsa World.
Right. Which I would take very different from big messages such as Christianity is, Islam is, Judaism is, Hinduism is.
Hey, but, you know, those are such complex issues.
Yes, they
that
are.
Even for a newspaper, with one with unlimited space, very difficult to take on. Because to do that, you have to be dedicated to doing it on a long-term basis.
Yep, right.
And it's the newspaper. Sometimes we just don't have the space or the time to take on that kind of stuff.
And I would say that you could do a 15-hour documentary series and still not really get, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to, you'd still offend somebody, let's put it that way.
Lifetimes of study, even. I'm going to respond very quickly in 30 seconds to some questions I got asked. In my definition in civil discourse, relatively equal power. Okay, conversation doesn't happen without a context. Who's at the table matters. The power they have, the wealth they have matters. Corporate citizens versus individual citizens at the table, as we're talking about discourse and about truth getting decided, that matters, which is why I said relatively equal power, I think, is a part of it. Last question here was that I'm going to take up is simply what should a church do how does church need to be part of democracy? Which I think is a fabulous question. I'd actually like to run a public course on that. And I would say the most important thing a church can do is remind everybody that they are created in the image of God, to act that way and treat others that way. And that's a wonderful thing that all of our faith groups can do to really promote a richer fabric in our civic life.